Hello and welcome to Business Daily from the BBC World Service, the business podcast which brings you the trends, the money and the people who make the world and its money go round. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Vishala Sripathma and welcome to Business Daily from the BBC. Coming up, the mining boom has brought jobs and prosperity to countries in the developing world, but at what cost?
I was on the farm when they killed him. I was listening to the news on the radio when they said his name. I didn't believe they'd killed him. I thought maybe he had just been injured. I didn't think he could be dead.
So is it inevitable that this trillion-dollar industry will bring controversy and conflict in some of the world's poorest countries?
If the world was to abandon mining investment in Africa or Latin America and concentrate only on Australia and Canada, say, that would be a great loss to developing countries who often really rely on those revenues.
That's all in Business Daily from the BBC. Many of the world's mining companies call South America home. The continent has profited from a global mining boom, which has seen the industry expand, bringing jobs to local communities. But those jobs and economic prosperity has come at a cost, both social and environmental. In Peru, for example, environmental regulations for large and medium-sized mining companies have been relaxed in a bid to attract more investment. But not everyone is happy about this. Widespread protests in the south of the country have led to several deaths. Grace Livingston has this report now from Espinar in southern Peru.
This is a protest march in the mining town of Espinar in the high plains of the Andes Mountains. The people on this march say the big local copper mine is polluting their fresh water, their rivers, their streams, and their soil. The women on the march are mainly indigenous. They're wearing brightly coloured shawls, hats with wide brims, and they're holding signs. One sign says, water is more important than copper.
Small farmer Gumisinda Pila says she lives at the foot of the mine.
From there, the water comes down with all its contamination. The sheep have died. Now there aren't any sheep. Our cows, we're having to cure them every week. And not only the cows. My daughter was born without an ear. It's not that we don't want the mine. It should do its work. But it should be careful about contamination.
In 2012,
two people were shot dead while protesting near the mine. Another man died later from his injuries. Their families accused the police of the killings. Delia Hancocala is the widow of 27-year-old Rudecindo Manuelo Puma.
I was on my farm. I wasn't in Espinar. I wasn't near the Antapaccay mine. I was on the farm when they killed him. I was listening to the news on the radio when they said his name. I didn't believe they'd killed him. I thought maybe he had just been injured. I didn't think he could be dead. I went to Espinar and then I didn't know where to go. Where would I find him? I found him in the hospital.
The Antapaccay mine is owned by Glencore, an Anglo-Swiss company.
La suma y la resta de los millares.
Glencore's Paulo Vera showed me around the social projects that the company runs in Espinar.
Yeah, CRE is one of our biggest projects in education because education is a very important focus to improve. So we are focusing many projects inside to give a complementary education and help to the students and to the all the education sector to get better results. No?
Paulo Vera could not answer questions about the mine, but in a statement, Glencore said, "All of our sites operate to industry-leading environmental standards. Our operations undertake environmental monitoring on a regular basis and are subject to both internal and external audits." I'm on the plane flying back to Lima now because this isn't the only mining conflict in Peru. Since 2006, 130 people have died in protests against mines and megaprojects, according to Human Rights Watch. Last December, the government relaxed environmental regulations, making it possible for large and medium-sized companies to start preliminary studies without first having an environmental certificate. Campaigners say looser regulations will lead to more conflict.
Gracias.
Javier Hanke is the director of Red Muki, a network of groups that campaign on mining issues.
They're making rules which put the rights of companies above the rights of people. Environmental deregulation will create more social conflict, more impact on the environment, and will create economic problems for the country in the future.
Porfirio Barrenechea from the National Ombudsman's Office says the state is right to promote investment in mining, but should be cautious about relaxing regulations.
We don't think that reducing standards of environmental regulation would necessarily reduce conflicts. On the contrary, if there is more insecurity, if there's more fear amongst the population that they are going to be affected, it's certain that there will be more complaints.
Hola.
Hola, mucho gusto.
But pro-government congressman Gilberto Violeta says the government has a good record.
I think we have advanced a lot in terms of environmental regulation. We not only have regulations which meet international standards to prevent the contamination of soil and air, we have a whole series of controls relating to water, which are getting stronger and stronger. There is very little water in Peru, and the areas where we have many mining projects and where we have cities and human settlements are where we have the least amount of drinking water. Tackling the issue of water is the key element to resolve many of the conflicts in the country.
Mining has expanded enormously in Peru. The area of national territory given over to mining concessions has doubled since 1991, bringing more and more communities into conflicts over resources. The challenge for the government is to create a thriving mining industry while also addressing the concerns of people who live near mines. Because for victims, like widow Delia Hancock-Gala, the cost of mining conflicts is very high indeed.
Grace Livingston with that report from southern Peru. Well, mines, as we know, can bring huge prosperity to countries, and it's not hard to understand why. The push and pull factors for the shiny orange metal can be a precursor for world events. In fact, the economics around copper is so important, it's often named Dr. Copper in the financial world because of its reputation of being able to predict turning points in the global economy. So we use copper a lot: homes, factories, electronics, power generation, and even transmission. Demand for copper is often viewed as a reliable indicator, therefore, of economic health. So rising copper prices suggest strong copper demand and hence a growing global economy, while declining copper prices may indicate sluggish demand and an imminent economic slowdown. Charlie Durrant is a metals analyst at the CRU Group. He explained to me the phenomena of Dr. Copper.
So really what that's been based around is the fact that the health of the copper market reflects the global health of the economy. And it's really because copper is used in so much infrastructure and across so many different end uses. About 60% of it is consumed as wire rod. So this is what goes on to make wire and cables. And these wire and cables are used across so many different industries. So you have them in transportation, you have them in distribution and power networks. And you have also a good amount of copper used in consumer durables, such as air conditioning units as well. Now, in terms of the kind of doctored copper argument, if you look in aggregate, since the year 2000, there's only been demand growth in China. Globally, about 20.5 million tons of copper are mined every year. The refined markets, that includes a bit of scrap, is about 23. And half of that is consumed in China. So I think largely the copper industry reflects the health of China itself. And as China's grown as a world power, obviously that's been mirrored in its consumption.
And so China is in the process of developing huge parts of its economy, and so therefore consumption of copper is high there because of that.
Absolutely. When you look at the world's largest consumer of copper, by a distance, it's the Chinese state grid. And Chinese copper demand growth has really been driven by this and the rampant construction demand. So just those two sectors in China are a quarter of all refined copper consumed anywhere.
So at the moment, with trade war concerns between China and the US, what's that done to the price?
Well, we think that's been one of the key factors behind the fall in the price. So at the London Metal Exchange, the copper price was trading about $7,300 a tonne in June. And it's fallen back by about $1,100 over the last 6 weeks. If global growth is affected as a result of further and prolonged trade actions, prices could come off a touch from where they are at the moment. It's very rare in the copper industry that prices really do start going very deep into that cost curve.
And so whilst trade concerns are perhaps keeping a lid on prices for now, medium and long term, it probably isn't going to affect the industry. Is that what you're saying?
Unless it severely hits macroeconomic growth, I don't think so. One other thing to really consider is the transition in China. As it moves away from an investment and government-led economy and more towards a kind of consumer-based model seen elsewhere, then copper demand is likely to plateau. And there's one really big unknown, and that's going to be to what extent green technologies start supporting the copper market. And this is largely electrical vehicles, but it's also going to be solar and wind capacity as well.
That was Charlie Durrant from the CRU Group. Well, mining companies make headlines regularly around the world. On Thursday, roughly 1,500 employees at aluminium refineries and bauxite mines owned by the mining giant Alcoa in Australia walked out over working conditions. That followed unrest at mines run by Glencore in South Africa and BHP Billiton in Chile. Strikes stoke volatility in global commodity markets, affecting the price of products from guitar strings to semiconductors. So why do these companies find it so hard to strike that balance between good, happy workers and making profits? Henry Hall is an analyst that looks into the social impact of mining.
There's huge wealth generated as a result. A lot of that goes to the shareholders of the company, which is why they go there in the first place. But in order to have a sort of harmonious mine, you need to make sure that those benefits are also felt by the various other stakeholders of the project, be that governments, workers, and communities. And I think the way in which companies have sought to do that is to try and build a much more sort of long-term strategy around how they make people feel that their interests are aligned with the project.
That doesn't seem to be happening, though.
Certainly in many places, it's not. I suppose the projects that are achieving it aren't in the news. There are certainly lots of mines which do have more sort of harmonious labour relations. In a situation where a commodity price is high and it becomes apparent that the company is doing very well out of a project, often unions or the government will want to redress that balance and get more of the benefits for themselves.
Shareholders are doing very well by investing in the likes of Glencore, but they don't really seem to get the grassroots correct in terms of that kind of happy medium, that happy relationship?
Certainly there are sort of international best practice standards that companies like Glencore and other big companies like Rio Tinto and Anglo American are part of. The key one there is the International Council on Mining and Metals that sets standards for its members to adhere to. Mining can have a huge positive social impact and economic impact in less developed countries, but inevitably by operating in those countries you will have more problems to solve. If the world was to abandon mining investment, and or especially if the more responsible companies were to abandon sort of mining investment in Africa or Latin America and concentrate only on Australia and Canada, say, that would be a great loss to developing countries who often really rely on those revenues. The local communities, there are lots of benefits in terms of employment, sort of supply contracts for those projects, and also just learning those sort of professional standards that having a big sort of Western operator can bring.
So do you think then the challenges are to do with the jurisdictions like you were talking about just then? So it's more about the legal complications of a country that is perhaps a developing country rather than the fault of the company?
Each country has its own complications. A lot of investors that I speak to in Australia say will often complain that the Australian government can sometimes sort of act arbitrarily or increase taxes in a way that the companies aren't happy with. So even the sort of OECD countries have their own complications. Certainly there are particular difficulties around community engagement operating in very sort of remote regions. And there is a big differentiation in the industry between companies that do this well and badly. And I think that can be categorised in four ways. The way one is to have a sort of long-term strategy and make sure you have the right information about understanding the jurisdiction which you're operating in. The second is to build strong relationships, make sure you're really engaging and listening as well as communicating. The third is perhaps avoiding the negative impacts of projects through technical fixes, often environmental issues like sort of water or dust or noise, and even other issues like corruption. There are approaches to managing those well. And then the final area is around ensuring that the benefits of the mine are shared. That's often around ensuring that taxes are visibly being returned to the government, that jobs and local employment are maximised, and also that all the sort of linkages and further benefits of the supply chain are maximised to ensure that their country is benefiting as much as it can.
And so do you think that countries in Africa and South America, are perhaps the challenges just much greater because of the kind of lack of development in terms of infrastructure?
Companies require a better quality of asset in order to invest in a developing country. And that's because essentially their costs are higher to develop the same mine in the Democratic Republic of Congo or in Canada. Often that's around infrastructure. It's also about the cost of capital and the interest the banks will charge on the capital they lend for a country like the DRC. At the same time, there is the issue you're raising there of accountability. And in countries with a more developed civil society, companies will be held to account to a greater extent. You'll see groups like the National Resource Governance Initiative, which is doing a lot of work to try and build capacity in civil society in these developing countries to ensure that companies are held to account.
Mining analyst Henry Hall, ending this edition of Business Daily. We'll be back on Monday. In the meantime, why not follow me on Twitter at BBC for Shala SB. Goodbye.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Honey, why are you packing a suit with swim trunks and sunscreen?
Because I can't wear the same suit for fine dining and kayaking. Total faux pas. Then I need something casual for the roller coasters. Oh, and the music festival. Meetings waterside.
Really? Looks like your work trip to Tampa Bay just turned into a couples trip through the weekend. I'll start packing.
Work meets play at Tampa Bay, where business and leisure blend perfectly. Discover modern hotels and easy vibes at visittampabay.com.